This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about environmental justice, educational justice, racial justice in America. With me to talk about these important issues is Antwia Combe, Assistant Professor of Urban Sociology and Africana Studies and Co-Director of Educational Equity at the Cesar Chavez Institute at San Francisco State. Antwia Combe, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Good morning.
Hey, give me a little background, if you don't mind, on yourself, and do you always want to be a professor?
Yeah. I think ever since I was 6 years old, I really started off wanting to be a writer, really wanting to follow the work of James Baldwin, people of that ilk, and W.E.B. Du Bois. And what happened over time was that what I really liked about Du Bois was that he wrote in triads. That is, he wrote social science, he wrote fiction, and he also wrote essays. And I thought that would be a real way to make a difference in everyday people's lives.
I mean, he did write for everyday people, too. He wrote journalism, and he was trying to communicate to as many people as possible, not just in the academy.
That's right. So I really tried to follow, I'm following in his footsteps in many ways.
And some of your issue areas are similar to him.
Definitely. I mean, he did amazing work. He wrote a really important book called The Philadelphia Negro. My PhD is from the University of Pennsylvania. I actually lived in the neighborhood, the 7th Ward, where Du Bois did his research and actually walked those same streets. Mm-hmm. And I think it's what's really striking is that almost 100 years later, so many of the problems that he detailed so well during that time are still actually affecting that community and so many other communities around the country.
That's haunting, isn't it? And what are some of those problems?
Well, I think, my work really focuses on what I'm calling eco-apartheid or ecological apartheid. And I think that really emerges out of my work over the last 15 years in low-income communities of color, really trying to educate our nation's young people. In particular, I want to educate all children, but I've really been focusing on those that are the most marginalized, the most disenfranchised, those people, young people who are sort of treated like disposable people in many ways and broken people. And I think I've suffered so many heartbreaks and pain and been broken in my own life in so many different ways, which we could talk about, that I really wanted to focus on how do we heal young people? How do we help young people reach their full potential? And as I really listened to communities of color, in particular low-income communities of color and youth, I found that there were two forms of apartheid that were really inhibiting our young people from being able to achieve their full potential. There was one form of apartheid that I call academic apartheid. And that had to do with typically overcrowded schools, a shortage of qualified teachers, inadequate instructional material. And I think Jonathan Kozol has written really powerfully about sort of academic apartheid, and as has Doug Massey, who was one of my advisors at the University of Pennsylvania for my dissertation. But there was another form of apartheid that I noticed that we were all missing, much more insidious, that I call ecological apartheid.
And this isn't just the environment. This is the greater ecology, the society?
I think it's a combination of both. I think as I was listening to communities, what I began to notice was that there were far too many schools located next to landfills, incinerators, polluting industries, right? That there were whole communities that were without grocery stores. Some communities would have 5 Whole Foods and a Trader Joe's, right? While another community that I'm working in had not one grocery store and maybe 60 liquor stores. And I really began to think about what does that mean for that young child who's negotiating that public and private space on a daily basis when they don't have access to fresh produce, when they have to go into a liquor store and maybe eat a candy bar instead of an apple, right? And what does that mean when they go into school? And what are the diagnoses that could come from that? Could it be ADD? Could it be something else? And I began to see that eco-apartheid was a real problem. That is, the disproportionate exposure of people to color to environmental health hazards, right? Based on not only race, because that would be environmental racism, but the disproportionate exposure of people of color to environmental health hazards based on the intersection of race, class, gender, ability, immigration, and so on.
So this is expanding the concept of environmental racism to eco-apartheid. I'm talking with Antwia Combe, who is the Assistant Professor of Urban Sociology and Africana Studies at San Francisco State, where he also is co-director of Educational Equity at the Cesar Chavez Institute. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. I can't resist the bait of asking you how you were broken in your own life.
Yeah, I mean, I've been broken in so many different ways, but I think the ways that the public might know me is, you know, far before this Henry Louis Gates case was my own case of racial profiling. excuse me. It was a case where I was going to my office. I'm a single father with two children. Going to my office at around 10:30 at night with my two children, 5 and 7, in the car, and I drove across, I live in Berkeley, drove across campus or across the Bay Bridge to campus at San Francisco State University. You know, I have never in my life left my children in the car. This was the very first time trying to be, do the best I could do in terms of being a teacher. Ran up the stairs. My children had fallen asleep on the drive over, ran up the stairs to get my books. And when I came out of my office, there was a police officer there waiting for me. And this police officer, basically, I was racially profiled and taken away from my children and thrown in jail and strip searched, put in an orange jumpsuit. And that was one of the ways.
What were you arrested for?
I was arrested for resisting arrest, which...
You can go round and round that circle.
You're right. That becomes a very circuitous argument. But I think, you know, the painful thing about my story is that, you know, every day, this could have happened to any of us was the theme, and every day this happens to many of us.
What happened to your kids that night?
I called my partner, and she came and got my kids. But, you know, the scary thing about that was that they said, you know, you have one phone call. And if this, you know, whoever you call, if they don't answer, we're taking your children away to Child and Protective Services. Right. But I want to underscore the point. Right, because this is not about me, right? I want to underscore the point that this is a systemic problem, right? And in many ways, I want to bring this full circle to where we first started, which is racial profiling is a systematic problem. It's happening in our schools and communities all the time. It is not something that just happens on the street. We're talking about racially profiling innocent people. That's what it means to be racially profiled, that you're innocent, that you haven't done anything, but you're being profiled. And what I want to underscore here for everyone is that whole communities are racially profiled, right? Our teachers are racially profiling our students every day when we track our students, right? Whole communities are racially profiled when we're talking about eco-apartheid, right? Where do we dump our toxic waste? What communities are receiving our garbage? Right. And we can think of that both here in the United States. The answer is pretty straightforward. That is, poor black and brown communities are receiving the bulk of our toxic waste. But on a global level, right, the United States as a nation state, we're dumping our waste on the poorer countries. Right. And so racial profiling is happening on a multiplicity of levels, and it's contributing to what I call eco-apartheid.
I'm speaking with Antwia Combe, who is co-director of educational equity at the Cesar Chavez Institute at San Francisco State, where he teaches and where he had that incident of racial profiling against him. I want to pick up on this question of tracking in the schools, because I think that's really nefarious. Mm-hmm. There's tracking in the schools by class and by race. And this has been going on for a long time, and it may be accelerating right now. Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, I think that what I'm interested in is how can we help all young people reach their full potential? And I think tracking is one of the ways that's preventing our young people from reaching their full potential. And part of the conversation that you and I are having today is, you know, the first thing you have to do if you really want to solve this nation's problem is identify the problems accurately. And so one of the problems that I've already pointed out is academic apartheid. Another problem that I'm pointing out is eco-apartheid, right? But we also have to then begin to talk about solutions. So
what are some of those solutions then?
I think it's really important to begin to look at what is the role of young people, especially low-income communities of color, in the green economy, right? Is there a place for young people who have been locked out or locked into the pollution-based economy, as Van Jones said? Is there a way to lock them into the green economy? And I think a great deal of my work right now has been around building sets of schools and educational programs that would allow kids who are generally marginalized, might be attending an alternative school or might be pushed out or being kicked out of school in many ways, or other people would call it dropped out, and trying to engage those young people in educational programs.
So the question is, how do you do that, though? How do you engage these kids who are falling through the cracks in the schools?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we're doing in the Bay Area is we've started something called the East Bay Green Corridor. It's a multi-sectorial project that we think could probably be a national model in it in many ways, particularly because we're dealing in such historic financial times. That is, it's a partnership between a number of different cities, right? Oakland, Emeryville, Berkeley, Richmond, 8 East Bay cities, the University of California at Berkeley, community colleges, all coming together to really bring a hub of green innovation and alternative energy. And what we're doing is we've started these green career academies. And what makes them so special, I think, is that you're giving young people the opportunity to both have an amazing college preparatory education, at the same time train for career technical education, that is, train for the workforce, give them work-based learning internships right away, and wraparound support services.
And how would a kid who dropped out of high school get admitted to one of these green career academies?
If you dropped out of high school, it would be more difficult. I think the innovation for the green career academies is who we're recruiting and what kids we're targeting in an early age. Because I think if you really want to do something about the dropout crisis, it's about starting as young as possible, you know, preschool and kindergarten if possible. So I think that our target has been to really recruit in pre-ninth grade and get those kids, 50% of the kids entering these academies are quote-unquote at risk, right? At-risk youth, which I really don't like that term, but for lack of a better word, right?
What's the matter with the term?
I think that it emphasizes the problem, and it also is potentially stigmatizing young people.
And puts the problem on them as opposed to us.
Right, as opposed to the system, right? Something I always like to talk about, and I think where the real impetus for all of this came from, is that in many ways our educational system is inequality by design. Right. And what I mean by that is, you know, if every year I can tell you how many kids are going to fail, if every year, like clockwork, I can tell you that this percentage of African-American kids is going to drop out, that this percentage of Latino kids is not going to get this particular grades. Right. If this particular set of indigenous kids, this outcome is going to happen too. If every year I can do that and predict it, every year, then that is not a system that is failing, right? That is a system that is in perfect rhythm, right, when it's that predictable. And that's how we know that it's a systematic issue, right, that we need to address.
And why is the system failing these kids, or how is it?
Well, I think I mentioned it earlier, you know, part of the problem is with the academic apartheid, the overcrowded school facilities, the shortage of qualified teachers, the inadequate instructional material. Another major problem is the lack of real engagement with the young people, right? I think if you really want to improve achievement for young people, you have to get young people engaged, right? Engagement leads to a higher achievement, which will lead to higher post-secondary transitions.
And is this emphasis on testing that Bush brought in, is that contributing to the problem?
I don't. It's interesting. I think testing has its place. I think that we're holding the wrong people accountable, as you mentioned earlier. So I think that what happens is you take these exams and you're holding kids accountable for not doing well, right? And where's the teacher accountability, right? I think that that's really the problem with the test. If you're going to have the test, then you have to hold teachers accountable for not being able to move the achievement outcomes of their young people.
But I've been talking to teachers, and they can't stand having to teach their kids to the test constantly. And they say it just dulls the creative faculties.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. I think that there's a way. Scripted curriculum is what they're talking about, is a problem in our schools, right? You've got to allow creativity for teachers to be innovative with young people. But I've also found that if you are innovative with young people and you are creative with young people, that then they do well on the test, right? And so the test, therefore, doesn't necessarily become the problem. It's about how do you get young people really excited about learning, right? And if the scripted curriculum is inhibiting that, then do away with the scripted curriculum. But then how do you hold teachers accountable? So there has to be a balance somewhere between the two.
Speaking with Antoya Combe, who is assistant professor of urban sociology at San Francisco State. He also teaches Africana studies there and is co-director of educational equity at the Cesar Chavez Institute at San Francisco State. If there's inequality by design, who's the designer?
I think that becomes a really broad, you know, a really broad ranging question. I think that there's a whole. My work is really focusing on the ways in which we can hold cities, schools, and states accountable. I think inequality by design, a great place to look at this would be the Williams case of 2004. In 2000, the state of California was sued for a lack of adequate instructional material, massive overcrowding, and unsafe and unhealthy school facilities, right? And I think that the last piece is really what I want to highlight and underscore for you. That is, the state of California was responsible for having healthy schools, right? So that means they're accountable for the design, right? The California Department of Education. And I think if you begin to look at the law and how that case was settled, the state lost, right, to the tune of about $1 billion, right? So I think you have to hold cities accountable. I think you have to hold states accountable, and ultimately all of us, our federal government, accountable.
And what has the state done since it lost that? Has it been redressing these inequalities? Has the budget crisis in California, which is symptomatic of a budget crisis in state after state, gotten in the way?
Well, the case was settled in 2004. The state since then has allocated $138 million in additional funding for standard aligned instructional materials for schools. And what was the second part of your question?
Well, just what the budget crisis is that cutting into the solution to the extent that they were, you know, obeying the court order?
This money for the Williams case was basically earmarked. So you can't touch it.
So they can't get at it.
Right.
You know, one other question I had, and I was looking at some of your writings, Antoya Combe, on on what you call the racing of our nation's school children. You address this, the question of middle class children of color, mm-hmm. Who are not disadvantaged by the structural racism in the school, the dilapidated schools that Jonathan Kozol talks about that you mentioned earlier on. So what is going on there with that racial achievement gap that you wrote about?
In the racing of our nation's school children, is that the question? Or with middle class kids?
No, just the middle class kids. And why is there a racial achievement gap there where the class situation seems to have been equalized?
Mm-hmm. I always say that I think it's important to understand that race subsumes social class, right? And that, part of what demonstrates that is the struggles that is what I call the middle class achievement paradox. That is that black middle class kids that are coming from really well-resourced families, their achievement level is still on par in many respects with lower income white kids, right? And I think we have to step back and begin to ask ourselves, what are the reasons for that? Right. And I think so much of my work has been trying to find and identify the problems that are inhibiting all children. But in this case, we're talking about middle class black children from achieving to their full potential.
And what are some of the answers to that?
Everything that we've talked mm-hmm. about thus far.
Okay.
Right. So, it's racism is a very important problem. There's a confluence of white teachers in our schools, white women teachers, and that's not a problem. All teachers from all races can teach our children, but we have to have teachers that are culturally sensitive, right, and that are racially aware. And to the extent that we don't have cultural sensitivity and racial awareness, is to the extent that we end up reproducing many of the stereotypes and stigmatisms that are inhibiting our young people from achieving to our full potential and not coming up with creative ways to engage those youth, particularly because we can't even identify with our children in the classroom. If a young child comes into the classroom and their cousin was shot, right, which is a reality in many urban classrooms today, and you have a teacher who's not from that community, right, or who doesn't understand those kids, what's happening is that teacher might go to that scripted curriculum and be implementing that scripted curriculum, right, without paying particular attention to the needs of that child or the context of that situation. So I think that we need teachers to be much more culturally sensitive and much more thoughtful and mindful about the needs of our young people, and about how children learn.
I'm speaking with Antwi Acombe, who teaches at San Francisco State University and co-directs the Educational Equity Institute at Cesar Chavez, San Francisco State University. You mentioned Van Jones earlier, and I wanted to ask you what you made of the cashiering of Van Jones.
I actually think that it's going to be great for environmental justice.
Why is that?
Van is an amazing speaker, a fantastic leader, and has really energized the movement around environmental justice, the green economy, particularly for low-income communities of color. And so I think Arianna Huffington wrote a really good piece in the Huffington Post that was saying, thank you, Glenn Beck, right, for doing us a favor, because you need people out there keeping communities energized and reminding people of the real message, right? That is that we need to be bringing people together to transform our communities, and not Van's role may not be best served behind a desk at the White House.
What do you make of the Glenn Becks of this world, and how worried about this country are you with the corrosive racism that just seems to be spewing forth?
Well, I think that what's happening right now is really interesting, because we have an African-American president, And many people actually wouldn't characterize our country as corrosive racism, as you have said. I think many people feel like the country is moving in a really positive direction. And so I think the danger of that is this whole idea that we are in some sort of post-racial moment, right? And that we are unaware of the real power of race and the reproduction of race to continue inhibiting people from reaching their full potential.
But Obama was feeding into that. He ran on the hope of getting beyond some of this racial junk that has so marred the landscape of the United States forever and a day, even before it was a country. And yet, there are so many people in this country who can't, you know, so many white people who can't deal with the fact that there's a black man in the White House. And that's what, you know, that's what Glenn Beck, that's what Rush Limbaugh, that's what those people are appealing to. So they've kind of put the lie to the hope of post-racialism in this country. And I just wonder how far this counter-revolution, which is what it seems to me to be, is going to go. Do you have a sense on that?
I think two things. I think there's a serious danger in this whole idea of post-race, right? And I think that our hope is, yes, to be able to judge people on the content of their character instead of the color of their skin. But I don't think that we are there yet as a country, and that's where the danger lies. I think that there's room for... I try to respect all people's views, right? And so the Rush Limbaughs of the world... That's fine. I think that my problem with that particular genre is that there's a sense of dominating both the airwaves, if you're looking at AM radio, and in many respects our media, right? And so I think that that's really my main issue with the right.
I'm surprised that you are so blasé about Rush Limbaugh, because to me, what I hear coming out of his mouth is just the most primitive kind of appeals to people. And I just wonder, to what extent it's gaining ground out there, or whether it just represents the same old 10% far-right, crazy, you know, bigots that we've always had.
I don't listen personally to Rush Limbaugh's shows that often. I know that he probably has a very major audience. But I really just try to focus on making, you know, the part of the world that I'm working on brighter, mm-hmm. right?
And I see this T-shirt you have on, Building Bridges to a Sustainable Future, Planet Youth. And I appreciate all the work you're trying to do to help people, young people... heal themselves, which is what you said at the very stop, at the very start, and to engage in the green economy. And Lord knows we need that green economy now, and we need to put people to work. And what better place to put them to work than in building the green economy and in helping people get jobs, especially young people, but young people of color, the most unemployed people in this country. So I want to thank you for joining me on Progressive Radio. My guest has been Antwi Acombe. Thanks so much, Antwi.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.